Session of the third and final day of the IAS conference in Sydney. My name is Diane Havler, and I'm from the University of California, San Francisco. And my co-chairs for the session this morning are Professor David Pennington from the University of Melbourne and Minister De Silva from Sri Lanka. It's a real pleasure to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Annette Soane. She'll be speaking about pediatric HIV. Dr. Soane is an assistant professor in the Division of Pediatric Infectious Diseases at the University of California, San Francisco, and is a Vietnam country representative for the UCSF Institute of Global Health. Annette is based in Ho Chi Minh City, where she directs a pediatric HIV research program. Her projects there have included studies of diagnostic and monitoring and testing of HIV-exposed infants, stigma, and discrimination, experience when accessing prevention of mother-to-child transmission services, contraception, and reproductive health outcomes of HIV-positive women. She is an active member of AMFAR's Treat Asia Steering Committee, Pediatric Network, and the Pediatric HIV Observational Database Working Group. It's a real pleasure to introduce you to Annette and to hear your talk.
Thank you, Diane, and I would like to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to provide an update on pediatric antiretroviral treatment issues. Healthcare providers face similar challenges in treating children as for adults, including knowing when to start treatment, the optimal drugs to start with, and when to switch regimens due to treatment failure. However, there are notable exceptions with regards to treatment coverage, the antiretroviral tools available for use in children, and priorities for ensuring a future that includes reaching adulthood. Of the approximately 2.3 million children with HIV around the world, 780,000 are in need of antiretroviral treatment, and 115,000 are receiving it. Although there was a 50% increase in coverage last year, only 15% of pediatric treatment need is being met. This is about half of overall global treatment coverage. And in sub-Saharan Africa, where almost 90% of the children with HIV live, children represent 14% of those who need ART, but only 6% of those who receive it. This graph shows the estimate of the total number of children in need of antiretrovirals from low and middle income countries. Total numbers on the left y-axis, with those needing treatment in red and those receiving treatment in yellow. The green diamonds referenced on the right y-axis represent the percent treatment coverage in each region. For example, in East, South, and Southeast Asia, the number in need of treatment is about 64,000, and the number on treatment is 13,000, representing 21% treatment coverage, whereas coverage in Latin America and the Caribbean is estimated at almost 70%. When Africa is added to the graph, the scale increases by one log. The number of children in need of antiretrovirals in Africa is almost 700,000, with about 85,000 covered. These numbers demonstrate the ongoing need for feasible strategies to prevent mother-to-child transmission and the importance of efforts to broaden treatment coverage. This table provides a more detailed description of a few of the cohorts of children on treatment in Africa. Data from Baylor's BPI program includes five sites. The Kids ArtLink collaboration includes nine treatment sites and the MTCT Plus network. And these MSF data include 28 sites, also primarily in Africa. Current national data for a selected number of countries in South and Southeast Asia also are noted. For the cohorts where data were available, children were older with a median age of about 5 to 8 years. One half to three fourths were already severely immune deficient at treatment initiation. Except for children in the Kids ArtLink sites, where 40% were on protease inhibitors, almost all of the children in the other programs were on regimens including NNRTIs. But the percentage of children already on second-line regimens or higher ranged from less than 1% in the MSF cohort to 5.3% in Kids ArtLink and 10% in the Baylor cohorts. Similarly detailed regional data for South and Southeast Asia are lacking, and the Treat Asia Observational Pediatric Observational Database, launched at this conference on Monday, will help facilitate better cross-regional comparisons in the future. The goals of treatment in children must be balanced between halting the effects of HIV disease and the long-term effects of antiretrovirals on a developing child. We know that treatment reduces mortality, restores immune function, and improves quality of life. And treatment is critical to preventing HIV encephalopathy and improving neurocognitive development. But although we want to maximally suppress viral replication to avoid treatment failure, pediatric providers must consider how to make limited salvage options last into adulthood. What is the future for those children who are already on second-line regimens at the age of 5? And when we start treatment in early childhood, we know we will face having to manage drug-related toxicities, such as lipodystrophy and bone density loss in adolescence. In deciding when to start, our criteria are based not only on clinical and laboratory markers, but also on the social environment of the child and the family. Like in adults, the goal is to achieve an optimal balance of benefits and risks. But it is the quality of the collaborative relationship between medical providers and the family that will result in treatment success and adherence. To better understand what start criteria were most relevant in resource-limited settings, the 3Cs for Kids cohort collaboration examined laboratory values and growth as predictors of mortality in 2,500 children who participated in studies in Africa and Brazil. They found that CD4 levels were the strongest predictors of mortality. In addition, malnutrition and anemia played key roles, sometimes predicting mortality in children with higher CD4 levels. And total lymphocyte count was revealed as a weak predictor in these children, which further challenges countries to improve laboratory capacity and access to the most. When available, the CD4 level is the primary laboratory marker used to determine when to start treatment. In 2006, WHO revised their CD4 thresholds, defining severe immune deficiency based on a meta-analysis of longitudinal data of almost 4,000 children in cohort studies and randomized trials in the U.S. and Europe. These thresholds risks of less than or equal to 5% in children over a year of age. It also emphasized the preference for using CD4 percentages over total counts in children under 5. However, data on optimal CD4 thresholds in resource-limited settings are still needed. Such data can help us determine how late is too late to start treatment in children. The Kids ArtLink collaboration conducted a meta-analysis of 1,200 children from clinical trials in Africa that showed increased mortality among children who were severely immune deficient when they started therapy. At 6 months after treatment, 7.8% of children with severe immune deficiency died, as compared with 1.8% for those whose CD4 levels were above the age-related threshold. A study presented at this conference from Thailand proposed to use immune recovery as a marker for treatment success, using the time to achieve a CD4 of over 25% as the target goal. 2/3 of children in their cohort reached the target median of 72 weeks after starting treatment. Although the median CD4 in this cohort was low, the CD4 recovery potential of Thai children on NNRTI treatment was comparable to other Western cohorts at the same baseline CD4 levels. But those with baseline CD4 less than or equal to 5% were the least likely to reach the target. From these non-randomized studies, it is clear that response to treatment is better when children are started before they develop severe immune deficiency. In addition, we now have randomized data to support that early treatment in infancy is superior to deferring treatment. In the SHARE study in South Africa, infants with what are considered to be high CD4 levels were randomized to start treatment between 6 to 12 weeks of age or defer until reaching CD4 criteria. During an interim analysis, investigators found a 75% reduction in mortality for the early treatment group, and the trial's Data Safety and Monitoring Board closed the deferral arm of the study. Further details will be presented during the Track B late breaker session this afternoon. The PREDICT study, currently enrolling in Cambodia and Thailand, is a randomized trial of children with moderate immune failure, and we'll examine how starting treatment in this middle CD4 range compares with waiting until they reach severe immune deficiency. These studies will provide much-needed evidence for determining optimal age and CD4 thresholds to start antiretroviral treatment in resource-limited settings. The question of what antiretrovirals to start with is largely answered by drug availability and local and national guidelines. Of the standard WHO first-line regimen options for children, the most common combination is that of D4T, 3TC, and nevirapine. In December last year, WHO and UNICEF published a pediatric HIV management guideline that formalized the recommendation to use AZT rather than D4T in children without anemia. This recommendation was based in part on data such as that presented at this conference from Thailand, where 57% of children taking D4T in a cohort in Chiang Mai had lipodystrophy at 144 weeks of treatment. But it is really the limited range of available antiretrovirals that drives what drugs are used in children. Liquid suspensions that allow for exact milligram per kilogram dosing are expensive, hard to ship, distribute, and store. Consequently, most of the world has been forced to split adult tablets into child-sized pieces. This has been an effective alternative, as shown by recent MSF and Thai studies demonstrating increased survival and virologic suppression. However, splitting tablets into anything less than one half risks under or overdosing. That means that children who require smaller sized pieces may be underdosed, leading to inadequate drug levels and risk of treatment failure. There also are the added barriers of having to cut unscored tablets and then administer bitter medicines to children who may be unable to swallow pills. What advocates for pediatric HIV treatment have been arguing is the need to develop generic and easy-to-use pediatric formulations. And as of last month, this is the list of first-line generic antiretrovirals in a pediatric dosing range that have been tentatively approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and are pre-qualified by the WHO. The table shows each drug option by concentration, company, and approval status. FDA's special tentative approval category makes these drugs eligible for purchase by the U.S. PEPFAR program. Of the 51 first-line generic options that the FDA has approved, 13 are in a pediatric dosing range. Of the 85 WHO pre-qualified options, 18 are in a pediatric dosing range. But none of these are pediatric fixed-dose combinations of either two or three drugs. Fixed-dose combinations have been the key to simplifying antiretroviral therapy around the world, and yet only recently have pediatric FDCs become available. There currently are four pediatric FDCs under WHO review. All are of the same regimen of D4T, 3TC, and nevirapine. They reflect the higher nevirapine to NRTI ratios necessary to achieve adequate drug levels in children. There are two lower dose versions that can be used in infants as small as 3 kilograms and two higher dose versions. As you can see in the photo of one of the Ramboxi products under review, they are scored, making them easier to cut, and they are dispersible, meaning they quickly dissolve in water. After negotiations by the Clinton HIV and AIDS Initiative last fall, the price for treating a child with pediatric FDCs was lowered to $60 per child per year or less. Pharmacokinetic studies of some of these drugs have been conducted in Zambia as part of the CHAPIS-1 trial. This sub-study completed data collection last month, but an interim analysis presented at CROI demonstrated excellent results. 64 children at a median age of 7 years, most with moderate to severe malnutrition, were given standardized doses of the pedimune FDCs made by Cipla. Investigators found that D4T and 3TC drug levels were therapeutic and comparable to adults. And more importantly, nevirapine levels were consistently therapeutic across all weight ranges. Only 7% of children had subtherapeutic trough levels, compared with the group's previous studies using adult FDCs, where up to 21% of children had subtherapeutic troughs. And there was no difference in drug clearance across the age and weight groups. This graph describes some of the CHAPIS-1 results, with time after intake on the x-axis and mean nevirapine levels on the y-axis. You can see that the mean levels of all of the weight ranges over time were above the cutoff, and none of the children had to stop treatment due to toxicity. Although these data are encouraging, we still need more pediatric antiretroviral formulations. WHO has an abstract at this conference, which is a sort of wish list for what we should be advocating for. Children clearly need a wider range of drugs and dual and triple combinations. To put this into perspective, remember that the first FDC was a dual combination of AZT and 3TC known as Combivir, which was approved by the US FDA in 1997. It is 10 years later, and we are still waiting for approval of our first pediatric FDC. Drug formulations are important aspects of providing pediatric treatment because providers and families need these drugs to be easier to deliver to children. Scoring dissolvable tablets or packaging granules into sachets to give to infants may seem like obvious solutions to simplifying ARV delivery, but they have seldom or never been product features. Complicating our selection of first-line regimens is the growing number of studies revealing baseline resistance in children. This table shows data from three studies in the U.S. where children had standard genotype testing before starting therapy. The yellow columns represent cohorts of infants infected during two periods of time in New York State. Within 2 years, the rate of having any resistance mutations went from 12 to 19%, an increase of 58%. The far white column represents data from a multi-site cohort of the USPACTG 1030 study. 24% of these children had pre-therapy resistance mutations. For all three studies, perinatal antiretroviral exposure was not necessarily associated with the mutations that were identified. Although these studies involved small numbers of children, this trend towards higher rates of resistance led to the recommendation to obtain routine pre-therapy genotyping in the 2006 U.S. Pediatric ARV Therapy Guidelines. And this concern over baseline and early resistance has been raised in other countries as well. The Botswana MASHI trial followed 30 infants, half of whom received perinatal single-dose nevirapine and half who received placebo. All were started on first-line therapy with nevirapine at a median age of 8.5 months. After 6 months of therapy, 77% of those in the nevirapine group had virologic failure, compared with 9% of those who had received placebo. Another study presented at this conference from Argentina looked at the early emergence of resistance among a group of children on either nevirapine or nilfinivir. 90% of these children had no perinatal ARV exposure. By a median of 5.5 months of therapy, 70% had already developed at least one primary resistance mutation of those listed at the bottom of the table of the slide. These data emphasize the importance of understanding how resistance is emerging in children in order for us to maximize regimen durability and prevent treatment failure. When treatment failure does happen, regimens need to be switched. But how we define failure depends on available laboratory resources. Although we have clinical and CD4-related switch guidelines, we have far less experience with how to use viral loads to make the decision of when to switch. PenPACT 1 is an ongoing collaboration between the European Penta Network and the USPACTG that will look at NNRTI versus PI regimens and switch strategies based on viral load. Whether or not we have access to laboratory testing to guide us, any decision to start or change ARV regimens is made with the ultimate goal to plan out a lifetime of therapy. Sequencing regimens into adulthood requires careful consideration and as much clinical and laboratory data as possible. Data from the U.S. Pediatric Spectrum of Disease study emphasize the serious consequences of multiple regimen switches. Researchers examined the triple therapy regimens of over 1,500 children and found that in 1997, 4% were already on their third or greater regimen. In 2001, that increased to 17%. Of great concern was that the regimen's durability, as defined as the length of a time a child was taking a given regimen, started out at a median of 13 months for the first line and then fell to 7 months for the third line regimen. In some of our countries, we do not even have a second line regimen to offer. So with few switch options, our focus should be on limiting resistance to delay treatment failure. Of the many approaches to delay failure, I will discuss three specific areas, including the need to support adherence in the home, using the best and most potent available drugs and regimens, and the importance of anticipating resistance on a global level. Even the most efficient medical care will falter if adherence in the home is poor. In addition to simplifying ARV delivery, we can work towards mobilizing resources to improve the social stability of families living with HIV. Providers and donors should recognize the impact that poverty, death, orphanhood, stigma, and violence have on a family's ability to care for their children. Comprehensive pediatric care and treatment programs can address these issues in parallel with clinical interventions. And as our population ages, we can encourage caretakers to begin disclosure discussions with their children as soon as this is culturally and developmentally appropriate. There were presentations at this conference from Thailand, Uganda, and Hong Kong emphasizing how disclosure can improve adherence in the home by involving children in the decision-making process. This is especially relevant as children transition into adolescence and are expected to take on more responsibility for their care. Another priority is to provide the best drugs for children, which may not necessarily be the same as the best drugs for adults. Data from non-randomized studies have questioned the potency of nevirapine in children. In a cohort in Thailand, 64% of those on nevirapine had virologic suppression at 72 weeks, as compared with 91% of the children on efavirenz. In a study in Uganda, the use of nevirapine predicted virologic failure at 12 months of treatment. This concern over the relative potency of nevirapine also was noted in a comparison between NNRTIs and PIs in South Africa. In that study, half of the children were on NNRTIs, of whom 90% were receiving nevirapine. 43% of the children on NNRTIs had virologic suppression, compared to 60% of the children on a PI-based regimen at 24 months of follow-up. The immediate impact of these differences remains unclear. Although there was a small CD4 benefit when using efavirenz in the Thai cohort, there was no difference in CD4 between NNRTI and PI-based regimens in the South African cohort. Randomized data in children are needed, but these studies have raised concerns over the long-term impact of virologic failure on resistance. We have the opportunity to delay treatment failure by actively anticipating the resistance we know is emerging. This includes providing greater access to laboratory monitoring to optimize selection of future regimens and switch decisions. Whenever feasible, this generally translates into CD4 testing, then viral load, and later to genotyping. With each progressive test comes greater expense and requirements for sophisticated laboratory capacity. Dried blood spot samples have been successfully studied for both viral load and genotyping, and would allow more sites access to these tests and reduce overall costs. But much of the genotyping being done in resource-limited settings is still through ongoing clinical trials. These and other research studies are critical to helping us learn how to obtain better treatment outcomes in children. And knowing how long it takes to develop and approve generic first-line pediatric formulations, we should be broadening second- and third-line antiretroviral availability. So in summarizing some of the current issues in pediatric treatment, we first remember that although the gap is narrowing, only 15% of the children who need antiretrovirals are receiving them. To expand treatment coverage, we require more and better generic pediatric antiretrovirals that are both potent and limit long-term side effects. We are learning how best to use these drugs through research, seeking to identify optimal times to initiate treatment and switch regimens. And if we hope to be able to offer HIV-positive children a lifetime into adulthood, we must delay treatment failure. This includes recognizing that social support for a child's family is as much a priority as the clinical interventions that we offer. I'd like to acknowledge the many people who generously contributed their experience, data, and time to this presentation, in particular, Jinchanat Annamoranich and Tanya Weepatanikit of Thailand and Lynn Moffitson of the U.S. Thank you very much.
I'm David Paddington, and it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Ben Burkhart to address us on outpacing HIV, viral fitness, escape routes, and resistant patterns. Ben Burkhart commenced his career at Leiden University, where his PhD was in the field of RNA studies with RNA bacteriophages. And then he went to Harvard Medical School, the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and spent 3 years of postdoctoral studies immersed in the molecular biology of the immune system with a continuing fascination with RNA. The next stage in his career was 2 years character-forming and highly productive at the National Institutes of Health studying HIV-1, still with a great fascination with RNA, before returning to an appointment in the University of Amsterdam in Holland, from which he has continued to be an extraordinarily productive investigator in the field of experimental virology, but still pursuing the machinations of the RNA system, both in viral evolution and its interaction with the immune system. It's with great pleasure that I invite Ben to now address us.
Thank you. Okay, good morning. I would like to thank the organizers, in particular Sharon Lewin and Damien Purcell, for inviting me. I'm going to present quite a few subjects, but the common theme, in case you start wondering about it, the common theme will be virus evolution. And I hope to convince you that the study of HIV-1 evolution is fascinating, sometimes quite puzzling, but many times rewarding and providing new insight into complex mechanisms. So in a sense, our research in Amsterdam is not investigator-driven, but driven by the virus. We just try to follow the virus on its evolution path and try to understand what it's actually doing. So let's start with some of the basics. As we all know, and you can find in the textbook, HIV-1 has an enormous genetic flexibility, although I guess we immediately have to bring that into perspective. It certainly has a high mutation rate, and we usually blame the RT, the reverse transcriptase enzyme, for that. That's probably correct. Although in some cases, I think we cannot exclude the possibility that RNA polymerase II, the cellular enzyme, that, let me see, I'll use this one. The cellular enzyme that makes new viral transcripts is actually also introducing RNA genomes with point mutations that end up in the progeny. And then you have this restriction factor APOBEC. Of course, we have learned that it's a restriction factor. It gives G2A hypermutation, and by doing so, it inactivates the virus. But there may be situations that actually the G2As introduced by APOBEC also help a little bit in the evolution of HIV-1. Of course, this virus has a relatively high replication rate. Again, many RNA viruses will do it similarly or even more quick. And it has a fairly large population size. Of course, the special thing about HIV-1, and in that aspect it's joined by hepatitis C virus, it's that it's causing a persistent infection such that you really get the time to build up a significant quasi-species. Now, let's start with a seemingly very simple evolution scheme that is the drug resistance against the nucleoside analog 3TC. Because for that you only need one amino acid change, and it always turns out to be the same amino acid change. The methionine at position 184 is mutated into a valine. Of course, we know that actually if you look carefully in patients and if you look early, that you will sometimes see transiently another variant, methionine 184 isoleucine, and we will come back to that in some of the later slides. And we know why in this case you always see this one unique amino acid substitution, because what you need is a very precise and specific substitution that can prevent the incorporation of the 3TC nucleoside analog. So if we zoom in the catalytic core of the reverse transcriptase enzyme, here in the palm region, There we see the structure of a natural building block, DCTP, and that is compared with the drug 3TC. And it has a different conformation. As you can see here, the ribose ring is sticking out. And over here in yellow, you see the space-filling model. And what the virus is doing, it's changing a methionine to a phalein. And as is shown here clearly, there is a steric clash between the phalein and this nucleoside analog. And of course, not with the natural nucleosides. And you can imagine that this is a very precise happening. If you have a substitution with a very small amino acid, it will not cause resistance. If you put in an amino acid that's too big, you will start to interfere with the incorporation of the natural building blocks. So let's move to ACT. The situation is already much more complex. You end up with 4, 5, and perhaps even more mutations. And if you look in individual patients, you see that the order of appearance of some of these mutations will differ a little bit. The type of amino acid substitutions that you select here or there may differ a little bit, and that already makes it very complex. But there's probably much more to it, because these mutations are the ones that we still see in most of the patients, and that's why they end up on the list of the IAS as the mutations that we have to screen for. But actually, if you go into databases, you will see that there will be much more. What we recently did is that we looked at the known resistance positions in the RT enzyme, and we looked for alternative amino acid changes. And we caught some very big surprises. According to the IAS list, at position 75, you have to look for this substitution, phalein to isoleucine. If you see something else, it's usually not scored. But in fact, in our Amsterdam database, and it was confirmed by looking into the Stanford database, we saw quite a lot of methionine substitutions. So what we did is we put the number of isoleucines that we saw at 100%, and you actually see that we see 6 times more methionines. Yeah, so both in our database and in Stanford. So I think it's about time to update the database. There also are alternative substitutions that are quite significant. This is just another example, but we have seen similar things at 15 positions. Here, usually you see a threonine to aspartic acid change, but changes to asparagine, serine, and many other amino acids are actually quite prevalent. So it's likely that there are many more yet unknown resistance-associated mutations, and some recent publications from other groups using database mining have shown that indeed these mutations are probably there. They may directly add to the drug resistance, or they may be compensatory mutations. Let's move to a more novel therapy, and the theme was already introduced yesterday by John Rossi, so I won't do that, but I would like to use the RNA interference therapy protocol, because again, we got some interesting virus escape routes. So here you see the RNAi pathway that you can program to actually start attacking the HFE1 RNA genome. And if that occurs, you're slicing, you're cleaving the HFE1 RNA. Now, it's a very nice method. It's beautifully sequence specific, but that at the same time, of course, will create trouble, because if it is very sequence specific, the virus will probably start to change its sequence. And you may expect that will occur exactly in the sequences that are targeted. So let's see how the virus escapes, in this case from an inhibitor that's looking at protease sequences in the polymerase gene. So over here, we looked at 28 escape cultures, and you will see that in this target sequence, the mutations can be found almost everywhere. Yeah. Actually, if you look carefully, you see this pattern, a mutation, then 2 positions, no mutation. Here's a very popular mutation that we see 8 times. Again, 2 positions, nothing, and so on. So the people that are trained in molecular biology will immediately recognize that these are probably silent mutations that are selected. So the virus becomes resistant by mutating the target, but it doesn't want to mutate the protease enzyme. Because the numbers are quite striking, 25 out of the 28 cultures that we analyzed have a silent codon change. So here we did similar studies with other inhibitors, individual inhibitors, because if you use them combined, you will actually not get any escape anymore. But these sums up the results obtained with four different individual inhibitors. As you can see, mutations appear everywhere. There seems to be a hotspot here around position 8, another one here at position 18. What's also striking is that the both ends of the target sequence are actually not mutated, probably because they do not provide a high level of resistance, because they do not significantly destabilize the duplex between the target and the siRNA. If you do many evolution studies, and this is actually the reason why we do so many, you sometimes come across exotic puzzling mutations. And this one certainly was puzzling, because here you actually have the target sequence, the gray box, and then all of a sudden we saw a mutation that appeared 7 nucleotides upstream. Not in the target, but upstream. That didn't make sense. But you already heard that my hobby is RNA structures, so RNA structures will actually give you the explanation. What the virus is trying to do, it's mutating this G into an A. By doing so, it breaks up one base pair. This hairpin structure is destabilized, and the RNA switches into another conformation, as illustrated here. And the target sequence is here, and especially the 3' end of the target sequence over here is base paired, and here it's totally free. And we know the 3' end is really the business end. That's where the siRNA starts to land, and apparently that's possible here. But over here, this structure makes the RNA genome insensitive, resistant to RNAi attack. Okay, thus far we have, talking about HIV-1 evolution, we have focused on selection, drug resistance, RNAi resistance. What we usually ignore is the first and important step of evolution, that is that many of these variants, they have to be made. And that's not all equal. And the second step of evolution is to select for the variants with improved fitness. So this is basically Darwinian evolution, even though, of course, he did not know anything about genes and so on. He had the concept perfectly right. So the mutational bias of HIV-1 is very decisive in many evolution scenarios. And, of course, it also forms the success of heart, because if you combine drugs, the virus would be required to come up with 4, 5, 6, 7 drug resistance mutations at once, and that apparently it cannot do. So what are the rules for these differences in mutations? Well, there are some very well-known rules and simple ones. Of course, a single mutation is much more easy than a double mutation and so on. This already means that sometimes certain amino acid substitutions are not within reach of the virus. For instance, ACT, this is a mutation that we frequently see, but it's a very difficult one, and that makes that the virus will not show this mutation early on ACT therapy. The virus really has to work on it for many, many months to come up with this, what we call a double transversion in this codon. So the second rule is that transitions, purine to purine changes, are more frequently seen than transversions. That's also a sort of a general rule in molecular biology. And then there's one special mutation that always sticks out, and we still don't really have a clue what's going on, and that is the G2A mutation. It's always number one in drug resistance, in RNAi resistance, and so on. It's unexpected, and as I said, we still don't know whether this is a special property of the reverse transcriptase enzyme to introduce a lot of G2As, or perhaps, as we suggested recently in an AIDS commentary, or perhaps this may be a role of the APOBEC enzyme, because the signature of that enzyme is to change G into A's. So let's go back to this very simple starting point, the change from methionine to valine in 3TC resistance. As I told you, there actually is in patients there is sometimes a transient form of isolucin, and I think we totally understand this sort of mixed pattern. First you see the isolucin change, and then later on the phalin. It has to do with these two steps of virus evolution. Because if you look at the codons, this methionine to isoleucine, the codon change is a G2A, and that's the number one. And that's why we think you see this initially in some of the patients. But then this is a little bit more difficult, not much more difficult, it's an A2G. But actually this enzyme and this virus is doing much better. It's more fit than the isoleucine variant. So the generation of the mutant prefers isoleucine. But if you then compare the two viruses or the two RT enzymes, you'll see that phalin at the end is a better solution. So here I just plotted some of our old data where we score for the RT enzyme activity of the wild type. The phalin, as you see, is a little bit lower, so lower fitness of the virus is expected, and that can also be measured. But the isoleucine is even further down in activity. So in the lab, you can, of course, play around with these type of evolution schemes, and we try to highlight this step number one. So not the selection, but the generation of the mutants. And you can do so if you start to dilute your sample during the selection of drug resistance. And you do that in a 96 well. And the key issue here is that once a drug-resistant mutant is selected, it will be in isolation. It will be in one of these wells, but it will not have to compete with any of the other variants. Yeah? So limiting dilution, selection of drug resistance. And if you do this experiment, indeed you get the expected answer that you see many more isoleucine because of the G2A than the phalin changes. So that's nice. That confirms our idea. Actually, there was a big surprise if you do this, because all of a sudden you see a third variant, threonine. And we have never seen that in patients, and actually we have never seen it in bulk evolution cultures either. Now it turns out that if you go down here, that threonine again is a relatively simple change. It's the middle position U mutating to C, but that is still more difficult than isoleucine, so you don't see it that frequently. Why don't we see it in nature? Well, that is because this represents a very poor RT enzyme and a very unfit virus. And it can only pop up in this clonal selection scheme because it doesn't have to compete with any of the other variants. Okay, we know of many more complex evolution scenarios, for instance, in the selection of protease drug resistance mutations. And I sort of plotted this five-step process where, of course, first you're going to inhibit the wild-type virus. Then you'll see the appearance of protease drug resistance mutations. And some of them actually will provide a partial loss of enzyme function and partial loss of viral fitness. Then we see a second wave of mutations, compensatory changes in the protease enzyme to restore enzyme function. And if that is not good enough, the virus will think about changing the cleavage sites of the protease, the cleavage sites that you will find in the CAG protein and in the polymerase protein. And then, if that is not enough, mutations have been described in the frameshift signal that coordinates the expression of the protease protein. And apparently, more protease can be made in case you still the virus is left with a wimpy polymerase enzyme. So it seems that the evolution capacity is endless, and the end result will be that you end up with a very fit and a very highly resistant virus. So if the question is asked, can we drive HRV1 to reduce fitness and low pathogenicity, I would say that is very unlikely. Let's move to another very surprising evolution scheme that we came across in a study we did together with Joep Lange on one of the first patients treated with T20. So this is a relatively old story, but very surprising. So this is a patient that failed on RT and protease inhibitors and he was put this initial success on T20 therapy. So we see a drop in the viral load, and then over the months coming, you see that there's an increase in the viral load, suggesting that the virus has become resistant. And we did some initial sequencing, and we saw interesting mutations, but it was very complex. So we decided to do clonal sequencing of different time points from samples of this patient. And we ended up, actually, before we could make the complete picture, we ended up doing 500 clonal sequences. And this sort of summarizes what's happening in this patient. So this is the pre-therapy sample. You see one box. That means that it's a homogeneous population of wild-type virus. Then, upon therapy, and these are the time blocks, you see that the total population moves to a variation. There's a mutation here in the what we call the GIF motif, and that is the known position in HR1 that's causing resistance to T20. The virus is not happy yet because the same codon is changed again to change the glycine into a tryptophan. About the same time, the virus has found a different evolution route, again looking at the same amino acid position with a different codon change, in which an alanine is introduced, and then things go fast because this mutant seems to win, but only after being combined with a second mutation in the HR1 region. We will have another look here what HR1 and HR2 actually are. So here we have a double mutant, the purple box here, and that starts to dominate the population. And what you would expect is that here over here, going from left to right, there should be an increase in T20 resistance. And that's actually what we measured. So thus far, it's not so surprising. There was one other point that made us quite interested in these samples, because when the patient stopped therapy, we saw a very abrupt and sudden disappearance of this double mutant. And later on, we understood this phenomenon, because when we made all these different mutants and double mutants and we tested them in the laboratory, it turned out that all these mutants are resistant, including the double one, but the double mutant is actually dependent on the T20 peptide. So it is resistant, but it cannot replicate anymore in the absence of the peptide. And that, of course, explains why it disappeared immediately once therapy was stopped. So how does that work, dependence? Well, of course, we thought about that a little bit. And this is sort of the most simple scheme of what's happening in the envelope. You see the conformational change that drives membrane fusion. And as you probably all know, T20 is a mimic of HR2, and therefore it already binds to HR1, and it will prevent this conformational change. Resistance to T20 is also fairly easy. We have seen, and many other studies have seen those before, there are mutations in HR1 that cause resistance, and what's happening is that you actually are mutating the binding site for T20 such that it cannot efficiently bind in here, and therefore the virus can still undergo a conformational change in the presence of the drug. How does dependence work? That's, of course, the key question. Well, we did a lot of experiments and of course, some thinking. And this is our current model, and I must say we have done additional experiments. It still holds. So the T20 dependence is seen with a double mutant, which has a mutation in HR1 and HR2. If we make this envelope protein, we see that it's hyperfusogenic, it's highly active, and it seems that it's undergoing this switch too early. And that's why the virus itself is dead, because this is not an equilibrium, this is a one-time reaction. And if you start with this scenario, you can perhaps imagine that now, with this mutant, the inhibitor comes to the rescue. Because the inhibitor is doing the same thing as it was doing here. It tries to bind in there and to prevent the conformational switch. And that, in this scenario, is very beneficial. Here it's inhibitory, over here it becomes beneficial. And that's why we think this variant can only survive in the presence of T20. Okay, if we talk about HFV1 evolution, we also should mention the topic of recombination. It's a major driving force, and you kept mixing of genotypes. Of course, we know that this is happening in nature because we see all these colored recombinant viral genomes, and that actually means that somewhere people should have been dually infected, super infected, or co-infection with two viral strains. And the key question that we had in Amsterdam is how can you detect these super infections? And for that, we now have a very simple solution, and that's based on the standard HFE1 genotyping assay. So these are some data from the Amsterdam database that we have. Basically, what we do is the sequences that look bad because you get a lot of these degenerate IAUB base codes. Yeah, you don't see A, G, C, or T, but you see, for instance, an R for a purin and so on. In the past, we used to throw these bad sequences in the garbage can. Now we look more carefully at them. And if you see a lot of these IUB, if you see a lot of these codes, for instance, more than 34, and we are sequencing 330 codons, so about 1,000 nucleotides, then we found out that in these samples, 43% represent dual infections. If you go to higher IUB codes, actually the percentage of finding dual infections even increases. If you go to the samples with the highest IUB codes, you will most likely find co-infections with different subtypes. Okay, so although dual infections are still rare, I think this is a very beautiful and easy, certainly for the labs that are already doing genotyping, easy method to use. Let me address one more topic before I end, and this is a basic science topic. It has to do with splicing of HFE1, and then you always have these complex slides because HFE1 makes 40 different spliced RNAs, and it's not just that, but the ratio of all of them needs to be coordinated. So splicing is really asking for a lot of complex regulation, and we know that the HFE1 genome is riddled with splice signals, enhancers, silencers, and so on. So what all these splice RNAs have in common is the use of a splice donor sequence over here. And I think we have some new information on the importance of RNA structure regulating this motif. And we came across this when we made some mutations that are shown here, where we here look at the wild-type splice donor sequence. It's situated on top of this hairpin structure. And then we stabilize this hairpin structure just a little bit. We remove this nucleotide and we put an additional base pair here. We saw that the virus is fully dead. So that's nice, but for us, usually then the experiment only starts, because if you have a dead virus, we try to select for escape mutants, and they gave a very interesting picture. And they come in two categories. The first category is shown on top. We see that the virus selects for mutations, additional mutations in this hairpin structure, to open up the thing again. So it doesn't like the hairpin to be closed. The second category is even more intriguing, because it sticks to the mutant hairpin, but it selects one-point mutation in upstream sequences. Initially, we didn't understand what was happening, and now it turns out that a new splice donor site is recreated over here. So this one is probably not accessible anymore due to the structure, and the virus creates a new one, and we proved that with RT-PCR and so on. So we actually think that in the wild-type virus, the RNA structure may also play an important role in down-modulating the activity of the splice donor site. I'm going to skip my vaccine part of the talk, and I just like to thank the co-workers in the field, in this picture, according to Van Gogh, and I thank you for your attention.
My co-chairs, distinguished speakers in the head table, Your Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen. I have been entrusted with the pleasant task of introducing the last speaker of this morning's session, Dr. Nancy Purdian. She will speak to us on biomedical HIV prevention current status, challenges, and future directions. Dr. Nancy Perdian is Director of International Programs at UCSF AIDS Research Institute, co-director of UCSF Center for Reproductive Health, Research and Policy, and a professor in UCSF Department of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences. Dr. Perdian has spent the last 17 years developing and directing a range of domestic and international research and intervention projects on sexually transmitted infections, HIV, and contraception in high-risk populations. In 1994, she co-founded the UCSF Collaborative Research Program in Women's Health in Zimbabwe. Her current research focuses largely on developing and evaluating the efficacy of female-controlled physical and barrier contraceptive methods that might decrease susceptibility to HIV and other sexually transmitted infections, and alternative strategies for fostering young women's economic independence, thus reducing their susceptibility to sexually transmitted infections and unwanted pregnancies. In Zimbabwe, she recently completed a study on the risk associated with use of intravaginal preparations and will also test new microbicides as part of HIV Net International Prevention Network. Dr. Nancy, floor is yours.
Thank you, Minister. Thank you, Minister. Thank you, conference organizers. Special thank you to Gita Ramji and John Kaldor for inviting me today. And thank you to those people who opted to stay for this rather than the 3D version of Harry Potter. Today I am going to be reviewing challenges and status having to do with HIV prevention. What I'm going to do specifically is begin with a very brief overview of particular biomedical HIV prevention, specifically HSV2 suppression, PrEP, microbicides, and female-initiated barrier methods. An issue came up in another prevention session about the lack of focus on IDU, which I think is a valid point, but this talk was put together really with a focus on hyperendemic countries in southern Africa. Then after that review, I will talk a little bit about the results from my trial on cervical barriers, the methods for improving reproductive health in Africa, and use those results as illustrative of methodological challenges faced by many prevention trials. And then hopefully I'll give you some recommendations that I have thought of for future prevention research. This is just a nicer slide showing you, again, what I'll be talking about: PrEP, microbicides, cervical barriers, that's my study, a brief talk about the female condoms, and HSV2 suppression. Beginning with HSV2, there are three trials, although the one at the bottom, the Wellcome Trust one with 821 individuals done in Tanzania, Debbie Watson-Jones just presented the results of that yesterday. But the others are ongoing. One, Partners in Prevention, this is a discordant couples study with over 3,000 couples being done in a variety of countries. The results are due to be out in 2008 or 9. The ongoing 039, which is funded by National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at NIH, over 3,000 women. And I think the results, I'm not sure about this, are due to come out later this year or shortly thereafter. There have been many sessions on pre-exposure prophylaxis here at this conference, and I'm sure virtually everyone in this audience knows more about it than I do. But I should say that I limited these slides to larger trials, not phase one. There's many things in the pipeline. So these slides are not absolutely complete. But there are four ongoing large studies looking at different antiretrovirals as pre-exposure prophylaxis.
the results. Somebody asked me this yesterday, when are the first results coming out? And the one with male and female injection drug users with about 2,000 people, I believe the results are due out in 2008 in Thailand. Looking at Truvada with men and women, over 1,000 people in Botswana a year later. The tenofovir study in men who have sex with men, again in 2009, and the NIH-funded study looking at Truvada also with men who have sex with men, due out in Peru and Ecuador in 2010. Moving on to microbicides, and I'm only going to touch on this very briefly because later today there's a whole session, I think, on microbicides, and Lut van Dam from Conrad FHI is going to be reviewing these trials in a far more detail. And again, I've limited this to the larger trials. There's ongoing NIH HPTN-035 looking at buffer gel and Pro 2000. The mechanism of action there is you've got one that's an acid buffer and an entry inhibitor with over 3,000 people in a variety of countries, mainly in southern Africa. The results due out in 2009. The Conrad USAID-funded Caprisa trial being done in South Africa with 1% tenofovir gel. As I'm sure you know, the second generation of microbicides, and you'll hear more about this later, really focused on use of specific viral targets and antiretrovirals. It's sort of vaginal PrEP. I believe that they've just begun enrolling with about 1,000 people in the DFID study run by the MDP, also looking at Pro 2000 with two different dosage, almost 10,000 people in a variety of countries. The results due out in 2009. And the Pop Council USAID Gates-founded Carigard study with about 6,000 people. And I think the results for this study will actually be coming out this November, I think. Moving on to barriers, there are no trials that I know of going on with the female condom, but I think it's important when we think about these biomedical preventions to keep this on your radar screen. It's been around for a while, but what I really wanted to point out is that there are some novel new designs. There's the Reality, the newer condom by the Female Health Condom. It's their second generation. It's made out of a synthetic nitrile product. PATH has a nice female condom that sort of dissolves when you put it in as a capsule. It's waiting for FDA clearance. And then you have the Ready V Amor latex condom, female condom. And I don't know, and I certainly could be wrong, but I don't think there are specific trials funded for HIV or expected, but I think this is something that we can't neglect. I'm going to skip the cervical barriers because I will be talking about my own study in that context. All of these studies, there's been well-documented challenges with doing prevention research. In particular, in some situations, there's been lower than anticipated HIV, high pregnancy rates, which have caused people to have to go off study. There's been challenges maintaining high retention rates. And difficulty, this has been a major theme at this conference, of suboptimal adherence. Again, Lut van Dam in her talk later today, I think we'll be talking about these in more detail, so I'm not going to focus on them as far as challenges with my own study, although I will talk a bit about adherence. I do want to just say one thing that came up in a session yesterday, and there, whether you can apply the standard of needing adherence to treatment of something like 95%, 98% to prevention, and I just think it's very important as we view this as a challenge for prevention, that people taking a drug when they are sick is very different from convincing someone to do something when they're well, and I think it's a much greater challenge for prevention than it is for treatment. Moving to my study, methods for improving reproductive health in Africa, and I, as I said, I'm just going to very briefly give you results. We have a late breaker at 4:30 today. And an article recently out in Lancet that go over much more detail. So I'm really focusing on this to discuss methodologic challenges. So this was a study where we enrolled HIV-negative sexually active non-pregnant women who were randomized to a diaphragm and a lubricant plus condoms versus male condoms alone. But all women all of them in both groups received risk reduction counseling, free condoms, diagnosis and treatment of curable STIs, also voluntary counseling and testing. Women were followed quarterly for 12 to 24 months, depending upon when they enrolled in the study. These are our main results. We had almost 5,000 women. If it was done in three sites, Harare, Durban, and Johannesburg. Overall, the incidence rate for all sites was 4, and our relative hazard was flat, 1.05. And if you look at site-specific hazards, although the incidence rates differ depending on the site, the results are pretty consistent, that we did not see an effect of being in the diaphragm arm. So what I'm going to talk to you today about is why that might have been the case and what are some of the methodologic challenges. Specifically, the challenges that I'll be focusing on are the difficulties of assessing multi-component interventions, and that we're looking at the effect of these new technologies in the context of a highly effective but maybe not sustainable prevention package, and I'll come back to that. Also, we had a particular challenge of having an open label design, and as I said, I'm not going to focus in depth on adherence, but I am going to talk more about measurement of it and more generally measurement of unobservable behavior. That's a critical part of all these trials. Okay. Just let me start with the caveat that these circles are really not to scale relative to what you did in the control and intervention arm, but I use them to make this point. As I said, we have a new technology. In our case, it was the diaphragm, in addition to an effective prevention package, condoms, STI treatment, counseling, versus this same effective prevention package in the control arm. And what you see is that when you are looking at an intervention that you're postulating has a modest effect, which is what we thought would be the case with the diaphragm, it's in fact very challenging because the yellow would be sort of our ability to look at the diaphragm alone because it's both part of an effective prevention package is part of the intervention, and then we're comparing that in the control. So it's very challenging to detect an independent effect of a modest level prevention technology. So then you might say, well, if that's the case and you have this effective prevention strategy, STI treatment, counseling, condoms, should we not just promote that? And I think that that's a fair issue and an important question. And so what we have to think about is that sustainable beyond the course of the study? And if yes, who's going to fund that? So as one example of that, this was a Ron Roddy study. The first author was Wong. Can these sustainable high levels of condoms, is it sustainable beyond the duration of the study? And they surveyed participants that were enrolled in their non-oxidal 9 study in Cameroon 14 months after participation. And you'll see, during the study, the percent of acts with condoms was 82 to 84%. After the study, 57%. The percent of patients reporting consistent condom use during the study, 64 to 67%. After the study, 35%. Now, did the condom use drop, or was it attributable to a change in reporting? Maybe they felt more comfortable. They might have over-reported during the study and feel more honest after, or some variation. But the point is, we do need to think about sustaining these packages when the trials are over. As I said before, we had the particular challenge of being an open-label design. People clearly knew if they were in the diaphragm arm and if they weren't. And an issue here is that the study arm can influence behavior and increase the possibility of lack of independence between diaphragms and condoms, which I'll talk about in a minute. I do think it's important, though, not to simply throw out open-label designs. There are definitely times when they need to be used. In our case, there was no placebo. So does that mean you can't test something unless there's a placebo? So we had no alternative. And in many of the microbicide trials, there is a condom-only arm. And I think it's important because it distinguishes the effect of the placebo from that of the study product. I mean, if the placebo had a protective effect, you would know, was it, say, the goop principle, you could separate that from the biological efficacy of the product itself. And also you could control for behavior change that might change with product use because you would know behavior without. Nevertheless, in our study, as I said, we did have differential condom use, and this is the proportion of women reporting condom use at last sex. This is the control arm, and this is the diaphragm arm. And as you can see, there are higher rates of condom use in the control arm. However, I need to disabuse a misconception that's actually been in this meeting. People have used this slide as being illustrative of behavioral disinhibition. And insofar as I understand that, that is actually not what we saw, because what's not on this slide, and I should have changed this slide if I knew that this misconception would occur, is that people in both arms substantially increased their condom use at, from entry into the study to the study itself. So there should be a line at the, from screening to here that goes from about 30% to almost 70%, that more or less. But it was just that after people were randomized, they continued to increase in the condom arm, and they even went up in the intervention arm, but everyone's condom use increased from entry into the study. It's just it increased more in the control arm. I should also say that in spite of this, there was no difference in HIV rates between the arms. So even though we did have differential condom use, there was no increased risk. Why could there be reasons for differential use? Therapeutic misconceptions. I mean, we were very clear, or tried to be clear, that the diaphragm was of unknown efficacy. But it is possible, and we're now analyzing some of these data, that in spite of that, people want something to work so badly that they might have misconstrued the fact that it might have been protective rather than it was unknown, and we were testing this. We also have some data indicating that the partner, male partner, may have been more likely to refuse a condom if he knew his partner was using a diaphragm. And also there's the possibility where, as we analyze some of our qualitative data, that using two products in your vagina might be less appealing than one. So to the idea of like having to have a condom when you already have a diaphragm, from the perspective of the women, may also be less appealing. Getting back to how difficult it is to detect an effect of these modest-level interventions, Steve Shabosky and my group, a statistician, did some post-trial simulations using the levels of diaphragm and condom use that we actually saw in the study. And in the diaphragm arm, in the intervention arm, that's about 70% diaphragm use. And I should say that when we designed this, we had postulated that that would be over 80%. So it was somewhat less than we thought had projected. 50%, this is overall condom use in the intervention arm, 85% in the control. Our power to detect a 33% reduction in incidence was only less than 25%. And we underestimated how much condom use there would be and the adherence to the diaphragm, and we thought that this was powered at 80%. So again, this is very challenging to detect an effect. Another issue that we encountered, which is measurement of self-report. Here I am telling you there's differential condom use, there's problems in adherence, but were people being honest about that? Can we really measure that? Another challenge in all of these trials. It's clearly not a problem for vaccines or circumcision or directly observed treatment, but right now there is no directly observed prevention, a biological marker for condoms or test products, although there are things that are being looked into. We need novel methods of self-report in electronic diaries or some computer. We had thought about a computer chip that you could put in a diaphragm that would register heat when it was in your body. But it's not only important. These issues of measurement are not only important for adherence, but also because of you have to measure confounders and effect modifiers. In all of these microbicide trials and other trials, you're going to want to know, did people use condoms or not? You're going to want to know something about their sexual behavior. Were they at risk or not? So very important, not just for adherence. So what is our bottom line? Our bottom line in our study is in the context of a comprehensive HIV package offered to all participants. We found no additional protective benefit against HIV infection from providing the diaphragm plus lubricant in the intervention arm. But I also think it's important to see what we couldn't assess. I mean, is this the death knell for cervical barriers? We could not assess whether the cervix was the most vulnerable. We could only look at whether if people didn't use the diaphragm, then we couldn't even assess that hypothesis. Keep in mind that one of the reasons we did this study is because, and Bob Bailey did such a lovely talk yesterday, there are actually some commonalities between the cervix and the foreskin in terms of target cells and epithelium. We also couldn't assess whether a diaphragm was as good as a condom. We also couldn't assess whether other cervical barriers might have worked better if we had a coitally independent cervical barrier, a one that you could just leave in or that was smaller or something like that. We could not address that. And finally, we don't know whether a barrier, a cervical barrier, would be more effective or promising when used with a microbicide. What are some of the future directions that I think we can address some of these challenges? One is behavioral research in the context of biomedical interventions, new study designs, and new research directions. This has come up in many sessions that I've attended, and that is the reality is there is no biomedical interventions without behavior. They're integrally bound up together. In fact, you have to be able to understand adherence in order to look at efficacy. And if you have an efficacious method, then your adherence would probably increase. But so you have to be able to address these simultaneously. It's not just a question of effectiveness. Even to be able to evaluate the efficacy in a phase three trial, you have to consider behavior. And in my opinion, the need for basic behavioral research is as important as it is to develop new biomedical technologies. I say that I think it needs to be done separately with great thought, not simply in a hurried way tacked onto an existing protocol, but we really need to take stock of how we look at these issues. From my perspective, the two most important behavioral aspects, but there are lots more, are adherence, which I've just talked about, and I think we need to understand the motivation, the context, you know, when are women using diaphragms, is their partner there? And then Liz Montgomery from my group gave a very nice presentation on male partner involvement. Do we need to involve them, or is that the worst thing you can do, and so on. As I said before, I think an essential challenge in all of these trials is the measurement of self-reported behavior, not only for adherence. If we had directly observed prevention, as the International Partners in Microbicide is looking for that in a microbicide, but short of that, we need to deal with these adherence and measurement issues, not just for adherence, but also for confounding and effect modification. I think we need to think more deeply. What is the value added for individuals not to say what you want to hear? If people are participating in the study, they're getting many benefits. I think for myself, if I was participating in a study and getting something verging on healthcare, would I tell the interviewer what I didn't want them to hear? How can we get around social desirability bias? There are other methodological work like the order, the type of questions, and I think we need new innovative confidential and anonymous tools for measurement. Some future directions that we've thought about. One is, could you do before a study a condom study? Sometimes you might call this a run-in, where you actually do a condom intervention and then randomize people who are only non-condom users or who have difficulty using condoms. Of course, you would continue to promote male condoms, but you're starting out knowing that you're selecting people that are challenged. Or would you only select people that are good adherers? Although this, of course, assumes that you can measure either one of these. There are also interesting post-randomization strategies called adaptive designs. I know less about these, where you can actually begin your study, look legitimately at your data, at your outcomes, and then tweak your data, making corrections to your power after you've already begun. If, for example, you find out that you could, in fact, find people who are better adherers after randomization. Another issue, and I sort of have a vision of people taking this slide and saying, oh, Padian thinks that we shouldn't offer condoms to the intervention arm. That isn't, I'm not saying that, but I think we have to at least consider our ability to detect an effect when we're doing such a great job with this effective prevention package. Again, not because that effective prevention package should be promoted in and of itself. It should. But for those women still who are unable to get their partner to use male condoms, we are still not able to address what they need, and it's very difficult in these study designs to get information that would be valuable for them. So I think we need to just think deeply about what we do. Also, I can't help but put in a pitch for this, moving sort of out of the realm of biomedical. This is a slide that was sort of my attempt, and it's obviously not every intervention that there is, but the green line's sort of money. So if you have vaccines, microbicides, barriers, you could have other things here. And then at below, interventions for gender empowerment, the order goes that there's more money up down the food chain. But the interesting thing, I think, is that if a structural intervention such as keeping girls in school, other kinds of strategies for empowerment were to work, we could scale it up tomorrow. And it's less appealing to funders. And I have often thought, if we could just take $1 million from here and put it here, we might see something. And I think the issue is that there's really quite a bit of literature here, but it tends to be sort of gray area literature. We need to look at these methods, evaluate them with the same rigor that we evaluate other biomedical preventions if not randomized controlled trials, rigorously done observational studies, but it's essential that they be funded so they can be evaluated properly, and I don't think we see enough of that. So what do we know? This has come up many times. What we are promoting, we're holding our HIV prevention with these new methods to a very high bar. And we know circumcision works. There's conflicting data, at least from the randomized controlled trials. There's other sources of data that STD treatment works to prevent HIV. Male condoms, I'm talking so much about how we should promote this, for which there are no randomized controls for HIV prevention. Our gold standard is not held to the same bar. Similarly, with female condom abstinence, reducing numbers of sexual partners, and postponing sexual debut. So how do we decide what gets promoted? Just want to end on a quote. Bradford Hill was one of the people, and a very famous, internationally known epidemiologist, did a lot of work on smoking and lung cancer, and he said, "All scientific work is incomplete, whether it be observational or experimental. All scientific work is liable to be upset or modified by advancing knowledge. That does not confer upon us a freedom to ignore the knowledge we already have or to postpone the action that it appears to demand at a given time. We have to move forward. We have to move forward in prevention. Things may change afterwards." I worry about the bar for HIV prevention. The fact that we would look for a method that would be 100% efficacious for individuals is a bar that I don't think we hold for any other aspect of public health, and we must do something. This is a raging epidemic. I'd like to acknowledge my funders, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and all the numerous people, both for, in particular, this presentation, and all the MIRA investigators. Again, we'll be presenting data on that later today, I think at 4:30. And this is just a montage of staff and participants from the study. So, thank you.
Nancy, thank you for an interesting, insightful, and inspirational talk. Thanks to all of the speakers and my co-chairs, and thank you to the audience. This session is closed.